being appropriately vulnerable is important. I'm not saying you've got to tell everybody all of your woes, but being appropriately vulnerable and being appropriately open with your team. And actually, when somebody does challenge you, don't jump down their throat. Don't try and defend yourself. Say thanks for that. That's really important. Thank you for that. In some ways, it's almost harder to get people to believe they're good leaders. They're so self-questioning and so kind of imposter syndrome-y, and they sit there and go, but I don't know if I'm good at this, I don't know. And you sit there and go, no, you really are, you're really great. We need you because you're a really good leader in this organisation. You've got that EQ. You do care about the people who are working for you. I've had some issues, some significant issues, and I did report them. That almost would have been fine had the reporting been taken seriously and been dealt with in a good way.
The longest way round is the shortest way home. C.S. Lewis's quotation is apt for Ruth Hake's journey to be the RAF's deputy chaplain-in-chief. She is, by her own words, a reluctant padre who's passionately committed to the spiritual and pastoral care of all those serving in the Royal Air Force. Military chaplains have a unique role, evolving to reflect the expanding breadth of faiths and beliefs. Ruth discusses the privilege of connecting all levels of leadership and the need to make time for people. Her moral courage and clarity of thought are palpable. Ruth also recognises the importance of being outside the chain of command. She reflects on when things go wrong and the difficulties of challenge. She offers considered advice about how best to do this. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Ruth.
There's chaplaincy service obviously in all three armed forces and obviously around in other places as well, in the NHS or prisons, that sort of thing. Within the Air Force specifically and the military as a whole, we look after obviously the spiritual side of things, so that our faith and whatever faith that is, we're a multi-faith belief organisation, but also what most people will know us for is the pastoral care we offer to all of the personnel. And that's utterly regardless of any faith. Really, it's meeting somebody's point of need. So it's whoever comes to us, whatever the issue is. And trust me, I've heard absolutely everything in my career, from the sublime to the very ridiculous, and everything in between. Non-judgmental. It's not really about faith. It might be my motivation for doing the job in the first place, but that's not important at that point. What's important is the need of the person who's come to speak to us.
And what took you into this role?
From the age of about 5 years old, I knew I wanted to join the Royal Air Force, and I knew I wanted to join in a sort of caring capacity that wasn't a real officer. Goodness knows what I thought at that point. I was 5 years old. I come from no military background whatsoever. I come from Sheffield. It's nowhere near any military. I don't really know, other than from my own perspective, that that's a nudge from God. That would be how I would interpret it, but other people may have other views. I wanted to do this job, and I thought probably doctor. I'm not hugely old, but even then, in those days, women couldn't be ordained, so I couldn't be a vicar. And I didn't even know that chaplains existed in the military. So that wasn't the job I had in my head. My dad was a vicar, but even then, I didn't realise that that was a job you could do in the military. So I assumed doctor. That was probably the job I wanted. And then I went to secondary school, and I vividly remember in my first year at secondary school sitting there going, oh, I don't think this is going to be me, because medical school apparently want like biology and chemistry and maths and things, not history and music and English and all the nice things that I like doing and was good at, and less so at the maths and the sciences. So I thought, oh, that's not going to be the thing. So by my mid-teens, I'd kind of decided that it was a bit like wanting to be a ballerina or wanting to be a fireman or wanting to be, you know, those things that all kids want to do and then give up on and do something else. I thought, oh, there we go. That's it. It was just my childhood fantasy, and I don't quite know where it came from. And as I was going through secondary school, I knew I really wanted to read history at university. So I went to university to read history. And really, my ambition had got as far as go to university to read history. And I hadn't thought anything beyond that at that point. I got to the end of my first year loving my history degree, but realising that had gone really fast and I only had 2 years left and I had to think of something to do at the end of it. And I wrote a great list of things I was good at and things I wanted in a job and things I didn't want in a job and pros and cons and all that kind of stuff. And I looked at it and I thought, the only thing you could do with that is be a vicar. And I very quickly ripped it up and threw it in the bin. I decided that was not for me. I, as I say, grown up in a vicarage and thought, no way, I do not want this. By that point, women could be ordained. So it was a possibility, but I was like, oh no. But that thought wouldn't go away.
Why were you so resistant to that?
Big thing for me was growing up in a vicarage, everybody owns you. You live in the shop. Mm. Everyone's got a view of you as the vicar's daughter. Sadly, when I was 8 years old, my older brother Matthew was killed in an accident. And I lived that whole thing incredibly publicly. Mm. Stories in the press and everybody knowing my business, everybody knowing about my family. My dad wrote a book about it as well. So everybody knew me. Everybody knew everything about me and all that very, very deep stuff that you go through as a child when you're grieving. Mm. And I think having lived in that goldfish bowl, I thought, I just don't want this. Yeah. I just don't want this. I got to that point in my university career where I thought, actually, that's kind of what I've been designed for. That's kind of what I should be doing. I'd done quite a lot of public speaking. I'd spoken about my brother and about grief, and I'd spoken about these things. And there's a little bit of put your money where your mouth is and, you know, look after other people who are going through that kind of thing. Mm. But also, I didn't want to do it. I was very, very reluctant. And I sort of phoned my dad very, very tentatively and said, oh, you know, maybe, very maybe. I don't know. It's probably nothing. I'm probably completely mad. Don't listen to me. It's fine. And he just listened to me the whole way through and just at the end said, yeah, I always knew you'd be a vicar. And I thought, oh, thanks for that, Dad. And I didn't really think much more about it. And then I went home for Christmas. This must have been in my second year. I got home and he said, oh, I've booked you in to see the vocations advisor tomorrow morning. Thanks for that. And every time I went to see the next person, there's quite a lot of stages. It's a bit like during the military, actually. There's lots of different people you have to speak to and there's a selection panel and all sorts of things. And every stage I went through that, I thought, it's fine. I was 19. I was a girl. We'd only ordained women for very few years at that point. There was no way they were going to say yes. This is ridiculous. So I thought I was fairly safe. I thought, it's fine. I'll say I'll do it and then everyone will say no and I can walk away and do something else. And they said yes. Every stage, it was very quickly, yes, yes, absolutely, yes, yes, we see this in you. And I found myself in Cambridge at Theological College, age 21, kind of going, I'm the world's most reluctant ordinand. I'm the world's most reluctant vicar. I do not want to be here. I thought my life was over. And I never, ever, ever felt that I wanted to be a parish priest in looking after a parish anywhere. I didn't see that at all. And so I couldn't really make sense of it and couldn't really understand what I was there for. Apart from the fact that it did, as a person of faith, feel like my vocation about where God was calling me. And then in my end of my first year, I did a placement with the army, rocked up at Catterick, kind of just thinking, oh, that'll be fun. And thought, oh, this is the job I've been wanting to do since I was 5 years old. Hadn't even thought about it for about 10 years. Suddenly, it made a lot of sense. And I thought, that's where I'm heading. You know, I really thought about I was a territorial army chaplain whilst I was a curate. So I had to do 3 years in the parish before I joined the military full time. So I did that with the army. And then when it came to joining, actually, it was always the Air Force, always the Air Force. So I applied to the Air Force and against their better judgment, I think, took me. And here I am nearly 20 years later. And I've loved every second.
You had a plan aged 5. You realised your plan aged 25 or thereabouts. You've done it now for 20 years.
Yeah.
You've enjoyed it?
Yes. I mean, there's ups and downs of any job. My first couple of years, I thought, this is absolutely amazing. This is brilliant. And they're paying me to do this. This is phenomenal. And then, of course, you get into the kind of the grind of things and things happen and things are a bit more complicated. But I wouldn't change it. The job I absolutely love. The job is something I'm passionate about, round peg in a round hole. That privilege of just being able to be alongside people, to be the person on the unit who's got a bit of time. To be that person who, you know, when something's going horribly wrong for somebody else, you're the person who's got the time to say, tell you what, sit down, have a cup of tea, tell me all about it.
And can we delve into a bit more detail about what that really looks like? Because across the armed forces, the role of the chaplain, not just today, but in historical terms, has been vitally important. Their independence from the chain of command. Mm. and that the people were able to go and approach them to talk about things that they knew would never be heard by the chain of command.
Yeah, being those eyes and ears and being, we call it ethical advice, but advisor to the chain of command. And that requires us to be a little bit outside of it. We are the person who is a bit different, deliberately so. We are the person who is there for everybody, without fear or favour. That works in both directions. You're there for the commanding officer without fear or favour, and you're there to be their sounding board, but also a little bit their conscience and a little bit the person who's got the different view at the table. So when you're sat around in execs or sat around in some meeting, you are the person whose view is very much to care about people because they're people, not because of what they can deliver or what their particular ability is or specialism is. You're there to care for them because they're people, but also to have that sort of slightly out with moral view of what's going on as well. And occasionally that means you have to challenge people a little bit.
Yes, I was going to ask about the moral courage aspect of that, because in some ways, with someone who has faith, it's ought to be easy because your boss... You've won boss.
My boss outranks everybody.
But at the same time, there's a view that you are part of the system. Having said that, I like that the way that people talk about padres is without rank.
Mm-hmm.
And so you transcend across the whole organisation from soldier, service person through to the most senior ranks.
Yeah, and each of the three services does that slightly differently. So the Navy don't wear rank, and that I think really helps when they're on board a ship.
Mm.
And that's very specifically because there's everywhere they go on board a ship, they're allowed to go because they don't have that rank. That helps them work that out. Both the Army and the Air Force do in a slightly different way. We do have rank. But I always say this, the RAF chaplaincy branch was set up by a Royal Navy chaplain and he chose to give us rank. So there's a lesson. But we all sit very lightly to it. Mm. It's always there for RAF chaplains and for Army chaplains. If you have the rank, it's only there to open up the doors for you to help somebody. I mean, our motto is to serve and not to be served. We are there to look after everybody else. It doesn't matter to me what rank I am. It only matters to the organisation, so they kind of know where I fit within it and they kind of know what sort of things they'd expect me to do. And actually, when you're on a unit, it's so that you can go and knock on the door of the CO. It's so that you can go and knock on the door of someone's boss and you've got a little bit of, they kind of go, oh, okay, that's that person and I need to take them seriously. So you use it on behalf of other people. Well, you should never use it on behalf of yourself.
And you talked about the eyes and ears, and I remember very well the brilliance of that function by the padre when I was a commanding officer, because in a hierarchical organisation, there's a risk of, they call it the iceberg of ignorance,
mm-hmm.
so that bad stuff can be filtered out wittingly and sometimes unwittingly. You're that fast track and short circuit.
We should be, absolutely. And that works in lots of different ways. So on a unit, you're there. You should be wandering around the unit. I mean, people think you're doing it aimlessly. Sometimes you might be. But normally there's a purpose to it. And normally you're kind of wandering around. And if you're particularly turning up in a particular section, it might be they have good biscuits. It might be that you're kind of just keeping an eye on what the kind of the temperature is in that area, or there's a particular situation you're kind of just going in to have a look at. You're not like a spy. You're not there to go and spy on people and go and tell the boss about it. But when there is a, you know, there's something not quite right, maybe a bit of toxic leadership going on within an organisation, or maybe just really running hot, people are really working incredibly hard, really long hours, and really they maybe shouldn't be, and that we might need to look at that. It's that kind of thing. You can go back to the boss and go, are you aware that this is happening?
Mm.
I'm a bit concerned about X area. They seem to be struggling at the moment. Or do you know what? They're feeling a bit unloved.
Mm.
They could do with you popping in and going and saying hi. And that kind of thing is really useful to do. But also, my role now at headquarters, I don't have a unit particularly to walk around, but what I do have is the whole Air Force. And I think the powers that be in a headquarters, it's very easy to feel a little bit detached from what's going on the ground. One of the great things we have is a whole load of chaplains who will send me every month, I get a morale report from each chaplain saying what they think is happening on their unit, how people are feeling, what's the big issues that are causing people grief, what's happening. And I can kind of look at that and sort of look at it across the board and iron out what's a very specific local issue, what's a big broad issue, what's something that's affecting everybody.
Yeah.
and be able to put that across to the senior leadership team, even to the specific area that might be able to deal with a particular problem. Infrastructure is always a perennial issue for people, but you can talk to the people and say, well, actually, we're finding this across every unit or across a lot of units. You know, that's a particular issue that's causing grief.
I remember distinctly when I was doing a job for the Army, we ran the bullying, harassment and discrimination mm-hmm. helpline. And no one ever phoned to say, I'm having a really wonderful day today.
No, they never do. No.
And as a result, often one got a skewed perception mm-hmm. of what it felt like for people in units. Do you get the good and the bad?
So you do a little bit. I would have to say station commanders and unit commanders often sort of say to you, oh, Padre, tell me what's like. And you think, I'm probably the worst person to ask because everybody comes to tell me their problems. And as you say, no one pops by to go, I'm having a brilliant time, Padre. Isn't this fabulous? As a Church of England priest, one of the joys of my job is that I get to be involved in people's marriages, people's baptisms. So you do get some of the joy of it in that. But also, you can run a listening skills course. We do something within the Air Force, which is called Camino Eagle, which is an adventurous training trip to Spain, and it's walking an ancient pilgrimage route mm-hmm. with a PTI and with a chaplain. So you do the two together. It's the physical, the spiritual, the mental, all of it together, building resilience. And those are great opportunities because people aren't in a bad way. Yeah. They might be by the end of it if they've walked too far, but those are great opportunities for people to really just enjoy being with people and help people see, maybe not religiously, but a different perspective, what might be food for their soul in a different way. And that's great. And also, if you're a good chaplain and you're out and about on the ground, you see the people who are having fun as well as the people who aren't. So there is a bit of a balance. It can be a bit, you know, if you've had 15 people come and see you that Monday morning and you're like, oh my word, everyone's depressed. But actually, there's a lot of good out there as well. And you do have the joy of being able to see that, which is good.
And you're looking after everyone, regardless of what their faith is.
Absolutely,
or none.
Absolutely. We're not there for specifically for those of faith. We are there for absolutely everybody, regardless of that. And when we're in a chaplaincy team, you know, you might have a Muslim chaplain, you might have a Christian chaplain, you might have different denominations of chaplains. Whoever walks through the door, they see the first padre they see, that's who you look after. If it's a particularly faith-based thing, so somebody wants a baptism, for example, that will come to a Christian denomination chaplain. If somebody is needing, you know, advice about their Sikh faith or something, we will obviously send them to the appropriate person. But if somebody just comes wanting some support, which is the vast, can't emphasise this enough, the vast, vast, vast proportion of people who come and see us just want some support. They want someone who's going to be on their side, who can listen to them, who can sit and have a cup of tea with them, who can be caring about whatever it is that's going on for that individual. There's no expectation that they'll talk about faith. There's no expectation that they will want me to talk about faith. There's no expectation about anything. Just motivated to look after a human being because they're human. And that's really important.
But I think I'm right in saying that all the major world faiths are represented in the Air Force and across the armed forces?
Across the armed forces, in different ways. Mm. It's a growing thing. We're trying to diversify and gain a greater breadth. So at the moment, in the Air Force, we have Christian, Jewish, Muslim and Sikh chaplains. Mm-hmm. And we also have civilian chaplains to the military as well, who cover Hindu, Buddhist, Sikh and Jewish faiths. And there's moves to look at broadening that. We've accepted Humanist UK as an endorsing authority. And hopefully they'll be able to send somebody as well who could be a humanist. So coming from a belief structure rather than from a faith background, which is a new thing for all of us. But I think, you know, a positive thing for broadening out to enable that spiritual side of things to be appropriate to the individual and to be able to offer that panoply that is required. So whether you're seeing a Muslim chaplain or maybe a humanist or a Christian, that care should be exactly the same.
What do you think the greatest challenges that you face are at the moment?
In some ways, our challenges are the same as everybody else's. We have challenges of deployment and being incredibly busy. Certainly in the Air Force, we are really busy. Sometimes that's great. People really love going on deployment. People really love doing the job they've been trained to do and they get really excited by it and it's really challenging and it's good. And then sometimes that becomes a bit too busy. And I think we're all facing that challenge of workforce and just having enough people and how we manage that and how we do the job we have to do. It's a challenge for chaplains as well. We don't have enough chaplains. So if you know a chaplain out there who you think might do really well in the military, send them my way. Be delighted to hear from them. There's also, I think, a challenge about when it's right to do that telling truth to power thing. That's always a challenge. You know, when are you just going to be the necky person having another go about something? Or when are you actually going to be able to challenge somebody appropriately and say there's things that need to change in the organisation, or things that need to change in the culture, or things that need to change along the way? And I'm not going to say I've always got that right. I don't know that I have. And it does take courage sometimes. It does take courage. That, I think, is a challenge. You don't want to be the one constantly going, it's really awful, because it's not. There's lots of bits of it that are great, but also you do need to challenge where there's an appropriate thing to say or where people are really getting it wrong.
Your role means that you're probably doing quite a lot of challenge. And as you said, you're choosing which battle to select. How do you find the responses to the challenge?
So people often describe chaplains as the most powerful people in the military, which always makes me laugh, because we have absolutely no power whatsoever. I can't do anything. I can't charge somebody. I can't do anything. On the other hand, I have access to anybody. And therefore, if you can get your point across to the right person, then you stand a chance of really achieving change.
Yeah.
It's knowing when to do that. So sometimes you'll get somebody who comes to see you about something you think this absolutely cannot stand. This is something that absolutely has to be challenged. In some ways, that's quite easy, because you're doing it on behalf of somebody else. Mm-hmm. You're saying, actually, I'm going to be the person who's going to stand up and be counted on this one. You've seen an injustice and you're speaking out for it. Very rarely have I had somebody in authority turn around and say, not interested. Not saying it's never happened, but it's very rare. I think where I found it more challenging along the way is when it's about things that have happened to me. I'll be honest, I'm a woman in defence. I've been in the military for 20 odd years now, and stuff's happened. I've had those occasions where things have been said that shouldn't have been said, things have been done that definitely shouldn't have been done. And you've got that challenge of, do I report this? Do I not report it? How do I deal with that? And I would say in my early career, I didn't report stuff. And I regret that now. I do regret it. I think I probably should have taken more of a stand. But you're in the same organisation as everybody else, and you're junior, and you don't know what's okay to say. And actually, I don't know what the reaction would have been had I reported some of that stuff early on. Probably not very good, I suspect. More recently, I've had some issues, some significant issues, and I did report them. That almost would have been fine had the reporting been taken seriously and been dealt with in a good way. It's when that doesn't happen and the organisation almost victim blames and gets into a sort of pull up the drawbridge and we're going to protect ourselves and we're not going to take that seriously. That's when you're left kind of thinking, oh, am I just going to sit here and accept this? Or do I have a duty in my position and my voice that I have and my ability to go and knock on any door, do I have a duty to take that and run with it and actually see if I can change a culture here and change the, you know, go away and shut up, little woman. We don't want to hear that, because that makes us a bit uncomfortable and we don't want to deal with it.
My observation from that experience is that you were successful in not only educating and informing and improving the understanding, but by taking the approach that you took, you handed the responsibility to those that were empowered to make the change.
And I think that's important. I can't control what anybody else does. As you know, I went and knocked on doors of very senior people up into the most senior people, and different people react in different ways. And you can't control that. You can't control how somebody else will take that. You can only control how you behave and how you respond to it. And not to say it's without cost, because it does cost. There's courage to go and speak to defence ministers. There's courage in that, to be able to say, this is what's happened to me. This is something that shouldn't happen to anybody. This is how it was dealt with. I don't like that. That's not appropriate. We need to look at this and change it for other people. I've got a 12-year-old daughter. I don't want her to have that experience in her life. And you can kind of get depressed about it, or you can try and change it. And I think sometimes it's depressing when you see things not changing very quickly. People sort of going, oh, that's terrible that happened to you. However, there's not a lot I can do about that. But still having the courage to keep going and keep taking it further forward. And there are wins. There are wins along the way.
Well, and I was just going to say that a wise friend of mine years ago said, we were working in the diversity inclusion space, and he said that one has to celebrate the small successes. Even if you manage to change things by a quarter of an inch, one should celebrate that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the more people are prepared to talk about their experiences, the more people are prepared to share with one another what's happened and to say, you know what, this is not appropriate. We shift it one person at a time, one group of people at a time, one area at a time, one team at a time. That's what we can do and change and be that person for somebody else. So if something happens to somebody else and they reach out to me, I don't do what somebody did to me. You know, you turn around and go, right, okay, let's take that on and deal with that properly.
Yeah. I think you're a dual serving couple as
I am,
well.
Yes. Well, and, we are.
And I mean, I take my hat off to all dual serving couples because it has its own peculiar and particular challenges.
Can do.
How have you managed that?
People often ask us, how do we do it? And I'm going to say a myriad of different ways. You make it up as you go along. My husband and I are both serving. He's not a chaplain. He would laugh at that thought. We juggle the childcare. We juggle the commuting. We juggle who gets the next tour or who takes the job that just works and all of that. We've juggled that for years. But there's a lot of different ways in which we managed it. You know, wraparound care, nurseries. My parents and my mother-in-law, bless them, have travelled the world literally to come and look after the kids. My mum managed to spend 4 months in the Falklands looking after our son at one point. So my husband, Brian, left the Air Force actually when our children were very, very little. He was a stay-at-home dad for 2 years, which sent him around the twist and he rejoined the Air Force pretty quickly. But actually, I'd had 2 maternity leaves, so I've been at home with the kids and he's been at home with the kids, and we've both had that experience and we've totally shared it. And I would say that's really important. He gets very cross that people always ask me, who's looking after the kids when I'm away? They never ask him that.
One of the great benefits of the role that you have as a chaplain is that you get to see lots of different leaders and how they either adopt their leadership style or if they just have one leadership style. Is that something that you see?
Absolutely. There are leaders out there who I would walk over hot coals for. And there are leaders out there who I would probably think I'd be quite happy if I don't work for them again. There are, as you've just alluded to, people who are very adept at changing their leadership style that will suit somebody or not suit somebody. That, I think, is a skill that really we should encourage, because it's all very well leading in a particular way. If you're suddenly in a different circumstance, that's quite difficult. So if you're an infantry leader and you're trying to lead people into a battle with bayonets fixed, that's a very different skill to leading people in an office environment. And when we take, as we do in the military, somebody who's brilliant at leading in one particular area and dump them in a very different area, and we expect them just to get on with it. And sometimes they do, and sometimes they can adapt, and sometimes they understand the difference. Sometimes people struggle with that because they're a fish out of water and it's not where they should be. And sometimes as a chaplain, you can be helpful because you can maybe give people a little bit of a quiet word with somebody who might be leading in a way that is less helpful in that particular circumstance. I think what I find fascinating is that as chaplains, we constantly have to sort of switch between leadership styles because we are neither one thing nor the other. We live in this kind of dual world of military and, for me, church, or for other people, different faith groups. And the church leadership, they want a very different set of things than the military does. And so you're always kind of having to kind of switch between the two. I always think it's funny when people look at you through a different lens as well. My civilian colleagues and church congregations probably look at me and think, oh, she's incredibly military. You know, she's incredibly smart and she's incredibly directive. And the military look at you and go, flipping heck, it's the bumbling padre again. And the perception of that is very different.
And I think increasingly there's a preparedness to receive feedback on how you come across as a leader.
It's a terrifying thought.
I remember years ago looking at JSP 757, which is the officer appraisal and soldier appraisal policy. And there was an RAF annex which specifically asked for and explained the importance of emotional intelligence. Mm. And that didn't exist in the Navy and the Air Force manual.
I mean, I'm sure you did have people with emotional intelligence in the Army.
Yes, it just wasn't a requirement. It was a bonus. Yeah,
wow, look at you with your emotional intelligence. Amazing. Yeah.
But now it's across all the services. What's changed too is that preparedness for feedback. And you have that unique position of having the trust, in most cases, I suspect, of senior leaders in organisations to have those kind of conversations. Do you find that you're having to do that less frequently now because others are stepping up to do it?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't really considered it. I think that's possibly true. I think people are a lot more able and aware to call out really toxic leadership where that happens. And thankfully, it's very rare. But actually, I think in some ways, it's important to call it out at a very junior point in someone's career, because actually if you do it when someone's a very junior officer and say, look, no, that's not really appropriate, they've got a lot of time then to learn and grow and be in a better place when they're much more senior. Difficult when that's what someone's learned for their entire career, and it's harder to change, isn't it? As we get older, we all get a bit set in our ways. I think what I find fascinating is that in some ways it's almost harder to get people to believe they're good leaders. Mm-hmm. They're so self-questioning and so kind of imposter syndrome-y, and they sit there and go, but I don't know if I'm good at this, I don't know. And you sit there and go, no, you really are, you're really great. We need you because you're a really good leader in this organisation. You've got that EQ, you do care about the people who are working for you, you do see the issues they're facing, and you are dealing with that in an appropriate way. And actually getting those people to understand that and believe it about themselves is almost harder than the person who you're saying, oh, I think maybe you could have done that a bit more gently.
We've had a number of guests on who are in the early stages of their careers, and they have talked about how it's much more difficult when you're at that stage to do the challenge. Oftentimes they've had someone, a good leader, who's encouraged them to do that and create the conditions for that challenge to happen. If you could give anyone advice to help with setting those conditions, what would it be?
Being appropriately vulnerable is important. I'm not saying you've got to tell everybody all of your woes, but being appropriately vulnerable and being appropriately open with your team. And actually, when somebody does challenge you, don't jump down their throat. Don't try and defend yourself. Say, thanks for that. That's really important. Thank you for that. I think the mentor system's really good. That gives somebody a formal way of talking to somebody about something and challenging somebody in a way that's supposed to happen, as opposed to, you know, oh, I think you've done something really wrong here, which can be quite difficult for somebody to do. I think if you're looking at challenging, if you think there's something gone wrong and you need to challenge a leader, maybe speak to one or two other people around you. There's strength in a group of people who, if a lot of people have sort of seen the same thing, you can share it with them, and then you know you're not off on a really random wrong track as well. And then see if there's somebody who is a bit more senior within that place who might be able to either go with you or do the challenge on your behalf. It might be that the chaplain's a good person to go to and say, look, you know, this has happened. I don't know how to deal with it. Could you come with me while I have this conversation? Could we maybe do some mediation or something along those lines, which enables you to have that conversation almost on an equal footing or on a more equal footing and say, this is how that made me feel. And I think sometimes how that made you feel is a very powerful thing, because the temptation when you say, you did this, they go, no, I didn't. I didn't mean that at all. I accept you didn't mean that, but this is how it made me feel. You can't be wrong about that. That's how it made you feel. And just as a leader, not to be intimidated by that. Take it in the manner it's meant, and then never, 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 never disregard the power of an apology. Because just saying, I'm so sorry, I didn't know that that's how it came across to you. I'm so sorry. How would it be better? And then hopefully that gives them the opportunity to tell you. And then you've got a great relationship with that individual.
Ruth's commitment to having courageous conversations is commendable. Even when your boss outranks everyone, it's sometimes difficult to do. I hope you enjoyed Ruth's reflections on leadership styles. It's clear when more people feel able to share their experiences, behaviours get better. I found her observation about being appropriately vulnerable particularly useful. And I really liked her reminder about the power of an apology. What stood out for you? We'd love to hear your thoughts at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Thanks for listening. Take care until next time.